This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're living in a world where intellectual property is one of, or possibly the most important asset a business has. Take the current legal battle between Apple and Samsung over the look and feel of smartphones. That case could transform the definition for industry of who owns an idea.
But here in Massachusetts, a recent case emerged from Suffolk Superior Civil Court that takes the question down to a much more granular, individual level. If an inventor moonlights on projects, who owns those ideas? The inventor or the institution he works for by day?
The case centers on the work of Dr. Joseph Grosella. He's a urologist at Mass General Hospital. He invents new devices on the side. And in 2011, Dr. Grosella created something he calls a voice box.
The voice box is a sort of a karaoke toy that I invented at my home. Essentially, it can help assist with people who may be tone deaf, or it can help with the intonation of someone's voice, and especially if you have a screeching child, that might help a child sing better.
So a couple of things to note. First, Dr. Grosella says he's developed a device for your larynx, not your reproductive piping. In other words, it's an invention that he says has nothing to do with what MGH primarily pays him for, which is urology.
And second, he said that he invented it in his own home.
My own time with my own materials, and I used my musical background and electronics knowledge that I obtained well before I went to medical school.
Therefore, Dr. Grosella believes he is the rightful owner of the voice box device.
But Mass General and its corporate parent partner's healthcare system disagree. They claim ownership over the invention for one simple reason. Dr. Grosella had signed an intellectual property agreement with the hospital.
Just to quote the partner's intellectual property policy, they own, quote, all ideas conceived of or brought to practice while employed at a partner's institution, unquote.
You knowingly signed that, so why do you expect this particular invention of yours to be exempt from that?
I would kind of look upon it in this way. Massachusetts General Hospital was rated the number one hospital in the country because of the physicians that were there. If you have the potential to be, since there is no exit clause in this partner's intellectual property policy, I would say that there is potential for people to, talented people, to avoid the institution since they may be subject to these restrictions of them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So here's the thing. Massachusetts is chock full of research, technology, and idea-driven institutions. Intellectual property agreements like the one Dr. Grosella signed, frankly, are as common as the soil those innovations take root in, a fact that Judge Peter Laureate pointed to when he dismissed Grosella's claim of ownership. This kind of quid pro quo underlines almost every professional association, the judge wrote.
So Dr. Joseph Grosella lost his case. Partners Healthcare System declined to comment for this story, but the case raises big questions about the limits of corporate ownership of ideas.
So listeners, have you signed an intellectual property agreement? Should a company really own just about everything an employee does, even at home, on their own time? Or does that have the potential to stifle innovation? On the other hand, would such inventions ever be created if it weren't for the community of resources and expertise professionals have access to through their employers? And the big question, what should the smart business do? Is there a way for companies and employees to reap the fair benefit of innovations that drive our economy? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at Facebook or Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. And on the web as well at radioboston.org. So these are great, fascinating questions. And joining us to sort of dig into them is Andy Beckerman-Rideau. He's a professor of law and co-director of the IP Law Concentration at Suffolk Law School. He's also a registered patent attorney. Andy Beckerman-Rideau, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Michael Moyer. He's a professor of law at the Boston University School of Law. Michael Moyer, welcome to you.
Thanks.
So first, let's get your top-line assessment. I mean, Dr. Grosella, he claimed that Partners Healthcare overreached in its claim on this invention that Dr. Grosella had made. Do you see it? Let's start with you, Andy Beckerman-Rideau. Do you see it as an overreach by Partners?
Well, I think you have to start with the basic law is that he would own anything he invents, even if it was at work, unless he signs a contract to the contrary. And it's possible a contract could be overreaching, but there's an important issue of kind of sanctity of contract. I mean, he did, from reading the judicial decision, it's clear he knew what he was signing. And so it's almost like buyer's remorse. He signed it, he agreed to it, and now he doesn't like the results.
So in fact, in the judge's decision, he quotes part of that contract, the IP agreement, and essentially says that MGH claims ownership to inventions that, quote, arise out of or relate to the clinical, research, educational, or other activities of the inventor while at Massachusetts General Hospital. So, Michael Moyer, does it sound like buyer's remorse to you?
I have to agree with Andy. Yes, he had the chance to negotiate other contract terms if he wanted to. And you'll find engineers and scientists in Massachusetts that recognize that, that talk to their lawyers and actually negotiate more limited agreements that allow them to retain ownership of some of their patents in some circumstances.
Okay, so but that's up to the individual to say, I want more wiggle room, essentially.
That's right.
Now, what about this question of scope? Because I think that's one of the things that really drew my attention to this case. And that is, as you said, Dr. Grossella did not renegotiate terms that he might have been more favorable to him. But on the other hand, there's this question of, you know, Partners Healthcare and Massachusetts General Hospital are essentially saying, you have access to information, expertise, experience vis-a-vis being a member of this institution, this world-class institution. And so therefore, that basically pushes out the scope of what we have a right to be pretty far. I mean, Dr. Grossella says, I invented something that has nothing to do with urology. That's what you pay me to do. So therefore, I should have a right to it. I mean, does that scope seem to be too broad to you, Andy Breckenridge?
Well, there is case law where if the scope goes way beyond what the person is employed to do, where courts have looked at the contracts and said they're unconscionable. The problem in this case is that when you read the judge's decision in the papers, it's not clear exactly what he invented. The decision seems to say, the judge seems to conclude it was related to what he did. And so the judge is basically saying it didn't matter where he did it. The real question was it related to what he is employed to do?
Mm-hmm. And Michael Moyer?
I again agree with Andy. You mentioned earlier in the setup for this piece that, the real question is Partners behaving sensibly? You know, they might have language that they can assert very broadly, but what kind of reputation do they want to create, I think, is a real critical question. And Dr. Grossella mentioned that they should be a bit concerned about creating a reputation for themselves that makes them look like a less than welcoming place for top researchers to be employed.
Mm. But on the other hand, Judge Peter Laureate noted that for people who don't like it, they don't have to be a member or an employee of Partners Healthcare. I mean, that's also part of the market that we live in. They may be able to go and find other employment.
They certainly can, and Partners needs to worry about public relations here. They need to recognize that top scientists might think twice. If Grossella is persuasive, if in cocktail chatter he convinces other urologists that Partners overreached, that there was some kind of understanding, that they would not enforce these agreements to the full extent that was possible, he might make other researchers think twice. You know, pushing the other direction, of course, is the reputation of the Harvard Medical Center that, you know, allows them to exercise a lot of bargaining power in these kinds of relationships.
Mm. Gentlemen, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I think Michael's right, and I think really we're talking about a business issue, not so much a legal issue. And I think it's true. They should really worry about that. And companies do take different approaches. I worked for a Fortune 500 company at one time. We took all the rights for the inventors, but we gave them an honorarium at the end of the year and a plaque and a dinner. And they were thrilled because they just wanted recognition. So there's different approaches you can take, different business approaches.
So I want to talk more about that in just a minute. But if we could, I also want to take a step back and sort of get to the core of why it is that intellectual property is so important to businesses in this day and age. I mean, I read one by one measure, for example, the The United States Patent Office issued more than 200,000 patents last year. That's a tenfold increase over, what, about a decade ago. So, I mean, are we seeing this trend that, and let's start with you, Michael Moyer, that IP is essentially, it is what companies own these days because they don't necessarily own durable goods?
Yeah, it's becoming increasingly important. They're starting in the 1980s, but 1985, there was an explosion in patenting in the U.S. About 1992, there was a follow-on explosion in patent litigation. So over the past 20 years, we've had tons of high-profile patent lawsuits. And as you mentioned before, Apple and Samsung and Apple and Motorola and Google, all of the smartphone companies are engaged in battles right now where they're asserting their patent rights against rivals, trying to trip up or slow down their rivals as they try to expand their market share in the market for smartphones. And companies, I think, are starting to see patents as a strategic tool that gives them a kind of a competitive advantage that is not necessarily related to the fundamental value of their technology or the fundamental value of their marketing approach.
So it's not necessarily that this one invention is going to make them millions or billions of dollars, but that by asserting some form of patent protection over it, they're raising a barrier for competitors.
That happens especially in industries the telephone, the communications, the computer, software industries.
Because otherwise the barriers are so incredibly low, Andy Beckerman-Rudeau.
Yeah, I mean, individual patents, very few actually make any money, probably less than 5%. But in many industries like electronics, if you have a package or a portfolio of patents, that's an economic barrier to keep competitors out.
So is that a good thing, though? Because if they're just using patents to basically raise barriers, is that ultimately going to... What if you're a small startup? I mean, you can't actually afford the legal cost of slogging through court to say, no, we didn't infringe on patents here.
Well, I think it's good and bad. I mean, it certainly can interfere with, to some extent, the development of technology. But on the other hand, it also encourages it. You know, when I worked for a large Fortune 500, we spent a lot of money to operate a research lab because we could patent the technology. If you took the patents away, most of that research would have disappeared because the company didn't want to develop stuff for the benefit of mankind. They wanted to develop it to make money.
We're talking about intellectual property and the fact that it is maybe the most important asset that businesses own, especially in economies like we have here in Massachusetts with all our research, innovation, and educational organizations that are basically in the business of creating new ideas. So have you signed an IP agreement with your lawyer, your employer, I should say, and did you think it was a fair one? And if you went off and invented a new technology or a new device on your own, how much of that do you think your employer should have the right to? Or maybe we should look at it the other way around and that these devices and new inventions would never exist if it weren't for the employers to begin with. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Forrest is calling from East Boston. You're on the air, Forrest.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that if companies are going to claim people's intellectual property, yeah, if they've signed this clause, then they should probably give them fair material support. I mean, our example urologist, if he is interested in creating musical devices and his company is going to claim them as their own, then to be fair, they should have given him access to materials and consultants so he could do a really good job of making them. Thanks.
Forrest, thank you so much for your call. Michael Moyer, let me get your response to that.
Harvard has a technology transfer office where they will market patents that they would like to either assign or license. And so they'll bring a fair amount of business experience to bear on developing the market opportunities, and they will share royalties with inventors. What's his name?
Grossella.
Grossella. Grossella might feel like he could have done better on his own. That might be right. If he really could have done better on his own, he should have negotiated in advance for the freedom that he wanted. But Harvard is going to provide some assistance to him. And faculty and universities are fairly happy with the kind of arrangement that they have with their universities. This is very common across American universities that faculty get patents, and occasionally universities succeed in commercializing them, and they share some of the royalties back with the inventor and with the inventor's department, sustaining research in the inventor's lab.
Mm. Andy Beckerman-Rideau, I actually I have the understanding that a lot of that basically the approach is different from country to country, and that many people in the global economy look at the United States and how it treats patent protection with maybe a bit of a frown, that there are just different takes elsewhere. I mean, how is it done, say, in Germany?
Well, there are some countries, and I believe Germany is one of them, where the inventor by statute is entitled to a royalty if the company makes money from the patent. But again, in some ways, that's a misnomer because the vast majority of patents don't actually make any money, except perhaps in the pharmaceutical industry. But in many other industries, it's the portfolio of patents which become valuable. I know when I worked, again, for a Fortune 500, we would file in the U.S. 1,100, 1,500 patents a year and several thousand in other countries. And only one or two of them actually directly made any money. Mm-hmm. But they managed to give us market share and to keep people out of our business.
And to bring it back down to the level of the individual, I do wonder about this idea that, for example, maybe many intellectual property agreements have similar covenants as to the one that we discussed that Dr. Grossella signed with Partners Healthcare, and that activities that you take part in as being by virtue of being a member of the organization will then lead to that organization having a right over the intellectual property. Now, I'm going over that ground again because it occurs to me that most of us in this day and age are not necessarily Renaissance men and women. You know, we're not inventing things that are well outside of our field of expertise. By virtue of our education and our experience, we're going to be inventing things that have a lot to do with our jobs. So, I mean, is it a naive question to wonder out loud if these intellectual property agreements do stifle innovation if people feel that they won't be able to monetarily benefit from their tinkering at home?
Well, to change topics a little bit, in Massachusetts right now, for the last several years, we've been thinking about the question of what happens when I leave work with this employer. So that's not the fact pattern that we talked about so far, but many companies routinely insist that employees sign something called a covenant not to compete, mm-hmm. which restricts the ability of an employee in a large established technology firm to leave and start up a new firm. The state of California, as a matter of public policy, refuses to enforce those covenants not to compete. Massachusetts, like most American states, will enforce those agreements. And so there's an interesting controversy about who has the better approach. And I think that California does. I think that facilitating departure and competition from employees is what has given Silicon Valley its vitality and allowed Silicon Valley to surpass Route 128.
Let's take another call. Subramaniam is calling from Lexington. You're on the air.
Hey, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought for today?
Thank you for taking my call. You are making a point very valid, which is what I want to build upon, and that is in today's age and economy, I would say the people who come up with the inventions are really the job creators. And to think that everybody cannot be Renaissance would be the thinking of the past. It's possible to train and educate people to think along those lines, and only those who come up with those ideas will really do well going forward. As a result, I truly believe the current laws and the covenants and the requirements for signing contracts are totally outmoded, and we need to think a completely new way of structuring our thinking and using the people's brains in the 21st century.
But Subramaniam, let me ask you a quick question. Andy Beckerman-Rideau a little earlier was giving us an example of how some companies, they do incentivize their employees to innovate by, you know, recognizing them, giving them plaques, maybe, you know, throwing a big dinner for them, essentially saying, you know, we recognize that you were the force behind this innovation. Is that not enough?
You know, that is almost like childish. I mean, nobody goes to work for a dinner. Anyone can buy a dinner on their own. The company doesn't need to buy a dinner or give them a plaque. They can get a plaque through the, whenever you get a patent, you can buy your own plaque. These are all the platitudes of the past 20th century. And we had to get out of that and treat the people who come up with inventions as the real people with ideas. And they should be treated as the job creators and with the kind of economic incentive that we are talking about for the rich guys of today.
Subramaniam, thank you so much for your call. So Andy Beckerman-Rideau, he says It's just not good enough to give a plaque and a dinner. So what are other smart businesses doing out there to both honor their IP oversight and also make, you know, potential inventors feel like they're benefiting economically?
Well, I think one important thing, and perhaps it's a misnomer among a lot of people, just because you get a patent doesn't mean it's worth anything. When I was a patent attorney, I tell clients the easy part is getting the patent. Raising the money, marketing the invention, and putting it on the shelf someplace where it's sold is extremely difficult. And so just allowing inventors to keep all their own inventions is not going to create jobs in most cases, because it's very difficult to translate that into something that can be sold as a product that makes money. It's not an easy thing to do.
Mm. Michael Moyer, I wonder, we were doing some research about other examples or other approaches to intellectual property from major institutions in the greater Boston area. And we were thinking about MIT, for example, that it seems a fair assessment to say that they're a little more relaxed about who owns the core or the rights to a new idea. Essentially, researchers can request that MIT waive its ownership of rights if those researchers can demonstrate no significant use of MIT facilities or funds, which is far less stringent than other organizations. Now, based on what I've heard here, that may seem to be MIT's way of saying we want to benefit as the institute, but also we want to keep you here. Because it's very easy for an MIT professor instead to say, hey, I can make a lot more money if I go across the street to Kendall Square and start my own company.
You're right. MIT's policy does look a little bit more generous. What really is critical, though, is actual behavior at MIT, at Harvard, at various universities. And I don't know that anyone systematically studied this. My impression is that across the country, universities as employers are relatively generous if you compare them to the private sector, and they care very much about their reputation. They do feel the need to compete with other universities to create good environments for scientists and engineers. Moving us back into the private sector, it's also really clear that many high-tech employers worry about, are our inventors flourishing, and they will share profit. They will actually make it easy in some settings for inventors to leave and start up a company, try to maintain a relationship with that departing employee. So there's a variety of behaviors out there in the business world. Regardless of what legal rights the employer might have, employers can always choose not to enforce those rights as rigorously as they could. And potential employees pay attention, especially in Silicon Valley. They pay attention to the reputation of the employer, and they'll look for a workplace that's going to offer them the chance to go out and start up their own business if that's what they hope to do.
In that case, Andy Beckerman-Rideau, it seems like potentially one mechanism to advance IP contracts is within the market itself. If people say, I'm not going to work for you, I'm going to go across the street.
Yeah, I think it's a business decision. Some companies take a much more flexible approach. Some companies don't take a flexible approach, and that's true across the board. I mean, the other thing I wanted to mention, Michael mentioned about universities being more generous, and I think that's actually an interesting issue, because I've talked to licensing people at Harvard and other schools, and they have said to me that, well, you know, we have a dual mission. We want to make money, but we also want to get the technology out to the world. Whereas in the private sector, it's solely making money. So it's not unusual that universities tend to be a little more flexible.
Well, what might seem to be the dry world of contract and intellectual property law seems to be growing ever more fascinating given the economy that we are developing. So Andy Beckerman-Rideau, professor of law and co-director of the IP Law Concentration at Suffolk Law School, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michael Moyer, professor of law at Boston University School of Law, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, continue this conversation online at radioboston.org. And stay with us, because coming up at the end of this month, women get 8 free health services under the Affordable Care Act, and we'll find out what they are. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.